Dodge 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Daria Albinger. The jury in Donald Trump's New York criminal hush money trial will resume deliberations tomorrow morning. Didn't take them long for them to ask their first questions today.
The jury seems focused on the Trump Tower meeting in August of 2015, where prosecutors say the alleged scheme to corrupt the 2016 election was hatched, involving Trump and Cohen and Pecker. And the jury wants to hear Pecker's testimony about the meeting and what Michael Cohen said about the meeting.
ABC's Aaron Katursky in court. President Biden hit the campaign trail in the battleground state of Pennsylvania, talking up his economic policies at a rally in Philadelphia. The governor of Tennessee has signed a law which makes it a crime for adults to help minors get abortions or gender-affirming care without parental consent. Hong Kong has convicted 14 pro-democracy activists in the city's biggest national security case. This is ABC News.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com.
Civic Media News, I'm Ella Saff. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. This summer could be the hottest in history. The National Weather Service predicts Wisconsin will see temperatures anywhere from 33 to 50% higher than normal in the months of June, July, and August. 2023 was the hottest year since 1850. Early signs of a record-breaking summer showed up last June when temperatures were around 2.7 degrees hotter than average multiple days in a row. We could see more temperature records fall in the coming months. More bad news on the weather front. Wisconsin's severe storm season is just beginning. Last year, 21 total tornadoes touched down in Wisconsin. This year, the tornado count is already 22 before the end of May. If a tornado is near, move to the basement or a room with few doors and windows. If you are outside, find a low, flat location and watch out for flying debris. And that's what you need to know. I'm Ella Saff, and this is Civic Media News.
Family Talk with Straight Talk.
You give and you give.
It's time to get with Straight Talk Wireless. You get a reliable 5G network and unlimited data, and you get to choose who joins your family plan starting as low as $25 a line.
Does it have to be family?
It can be family or people you like.
Get more lines and more savings. Switch to Straight Talk for family plans starting as low as $25 a line per month for 4 lines. Find us at Walmart and StraightTalk.com. For network management practices, visit StraightTalk.com. Family plan discount with 4 lines all on the Silver Unlimited plan. Taxes and fees apply.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Up North News Radio.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. You know, American prosperity, something we love to talk about in this country. We love the story of the prosperous, you know, the men who built America. But, you know, American prosperity has always had deep roots in good old-fashioned American exploitation. The person who figures out how to benefit off of the misfortune, the desperation of others, they get wildly wealthy. That's America. It's been that way for a while. And I've said many times here on the program, show me a billionaire, and I'll bet there's a long line of people that they've screwed over along the way. We got a guy who's running for president, the poster child for that. America's corporations, they and our wealth class, let's not let them off the hook. They're addicted to cheap labor, to cheap, exploitable labor. And look, even a lot of middle class and working class folks addicted to cheap, exploitable labor. Because, hey, we want cheap stuff. We want a basket full of stuff from the Wally World place for pennies. Now, look, not new. You know, this is, to be honest, it's been this way probably from the beginning of time. The idea that your loss is my gain. Hooray for me and the heck with you. But today I was thinking about the convict lease program of the late 19th century, lasted into the 20th century. Or I shouldn't say that. At least we think it ended in the early 20th century. Because, you know, for those who don't know, the convict lease program was something that propped up after the Civil War. This idea that, you know, states needed cheap labor. And under this convict lease system, state governments, you know, pimped out their prisoners. Leased prisoners to private businesses, to plantations, to railroads, to mines, to break strikes, all kinds of stuff. And you go back to the post-Civil War era, the Reconstruction era. You know, after the Civil War, you know, the Southern economy was devastated. And there was a significant need for cheap labor to rebuild. They needed infrastructure. They needed agriculture production. They needed stuff. And they were used to free labor. They were used to, you know, slave, get over there and do that. And at the same time, you now had these newly emancipated African-Americans facing what was systematic discrimination and a lack of opportunities by design. You also had Southern states who were struggling with the costs of prisons because we were locking all these people up. We didn't want these slaves walking around like the rest of us. So we got a bunch of petty little crimes to lock people up. And it cost a little bit of money. And what they saw was an opportunity to profit off of this new cheap labor. Reduce expenses, generate revenue, good for business. And that's what they did. And the practice began, full tilt boogie in the late 1860s. You had these states who were, you know, selling these people off, leasing them. Because here's the thing, slavery, you had to own the person. You had to take care of them, you had to feed them, you had to water them, had to house them, had to do all this stuff. No, not this. You rented them. You leased them for just a little bit of time to get what you needed. And then you sent them back to have their own problems. And they did your labor for a fixed fee. You got to rent them. The state made a little bit of money. It was a win-win for the state, for corporate America, not so much for the people that were being locked up. Now, what you had was a situation where people were going, this ain't right. Conditions were horrible. Again, when you have the ability to exploit someone, it's easy to treat them harshly. It's easy to have them toil in inhumane conditions. It's easy to not have adequate food, clothing, medical care, housing. It's easy to do that because they're just slaves anyway. That was the mentality. And what you had was a high mortality rate because they were overworking these people. They weren't feeding. They were dying of malnutrition. They were dying of diseases and mistreatment, all kinds of stuff. Because again, the people who were leasing them didn't own them. They were now prisoners. They were less than slaves. And this was working well because you had those people in their place. And you still got the cheap labor without the cost of owning them. And this is the reality of where we came from. So I was thinking about this today because, again, when you look at these convict lease programs, there weren't a lot of white people doing it. It was you know, mostly young black men. Why? Work. We need it. So my mind started going to, you know, what caused the stop? You know, in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, you saw the reports coming out of abuses and all these inhumane treatment of people and how this, and the public started going, I'm not comfortable with this, especially in the North. You had progressive reformers, labor activists, labor agitators who were out there, journalists exposing just how bad this system was, calling for its abolition. And many states did. Alabama was one of the last to formally end the convict lease program in 1928. And you go, but Rick, I'm seeing stories that prison labor is alive and well in America today. Truth of the matter is, it is. Because corporate America needs cheap labor. And they need exploitable labor. They need to line their pockets at the expense of the exploitable. And I look at this recent story by Josh Idelson over at Bloomberg, who tells the story of a woman in Alabama, in an Alabama prison, whose job it is, while in prison, to work on an assembly line at this meat processing plant for this meat company. They're a supermarket supplier. She works 12 hours a day on her feet the whole time in 30-degree temperature. You know, again, you know, just horrible stuff. And I'm sure not with the kind of attire you would need. She's paid $13 an hour. And you go, well, that's not bad. She's in prison. She makes $13 an hour. No, no. She doesn't make $13 an hour. The state pockets a good portion of it. The state pocket most of it, including two-fifths just to the Alabama Department of Corrections, you know, to help defray the costs of her incarceration. And you go, that sounds a lot like back then. Yeah, because it is. And according to a 2022 study by the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, and the University of Chicago, Alabama makes about $450 million off of prison labor. As a country, there are more than 800,000 people in prison, and they do about $10 billion worth of work a year, more than $2 billion of it for clients outside the prison system. Yes, corporate America. It's not like you're going out there doing some light farming in the fields to feed the prison. No, no, you're doing some work for the biggest companies in this country. And there's a lawsuit now, and this is, you know, thank goodness for lawyers and labor agitators and labor unions, who this woman and nine people who are still incarcerated have filed a class action lawsuit. They're suing Alabama Governor Kay Ivey, the state's attorney general, the prison commissioner, the parole board, everyone, the slew of cities, all kinds of stuff, and the companies that rely on this, what they're calling forced labor. Prison labor, slave labor, however you want to put it, convict lease labor. Today, in this day and age, this is going on. Now, the question is, why isn't there any mass outrage? Why aren't we seeing this on the mainstream media? Because we don't care. It's the same reason we're not seeing the stories about all the children that are you know, working in these meat packing plants and in these food processing plants. We see these stories on child labor almost every day. But, you know, the idea that exploitative abuses of the past are in the past is a fallacy. And it seems we don't care. And this is where I'm struggling, because I do. And I think America does too, especially if they were kids that look like yours. The sad reality is a lot of these people, they don't. They're the poor. They're the desperate. They're the ones that society has, well, not prioritized. Because if there were people that look like you and me doing those jobs, you bet there'd be a commission. There'd be something to go, what? Convict lease programming, that stuff was outlawed decades ago. And now there's a lawsuit. And you wonder, where is it going to go? So when I think about the past, kind of looks like the present. And the question is can we learn from the past so that we don't continue the present into the future? And this is why actual learning of history, in my view, kind of important. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Are there, in your state, are they using prison labor? It's not just about license plates. Are they using prison labor to, well, enrich the big corporate behemoth and the wealth class? I want to hear it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So our quote of the day, and you know it's got to be a Trump quote of the day. he put on the little Truth Social, in all caps, mind you. He asks the question, why is the corrupt government allowed to make the final argument in the case against me? Why can't the defense go last? Big advantage, very unfair, witch hunt. And I saw this, and my first thought was, tell me you know nothing about our legal system without telling me you know nothing about our legal system and where you've been for the last, 200 and some odd years? Just kind of a thought. The big libertarian powwow happened over the weekend. Yes, all the libertarians got together and talked about how much they hate government. And Donald Trump actually showed up, got booed. But he showed up and here to share some thoughts on the libertarian powwow. I've asked our good friend Pat LaMarche to come talk with us. Pat is one of my favorite writers over at the Bucks County Beacon. She's also an author and a homelessness awareness advocate. Pat, thanks for taking time for us.
I just love this show, Rick. I'm always happy to be on it.
So what do you make of Trump saying I should get to go last?
Oh, well, I just thought that was great because this is, depending on how this trial turns out, he's already lost like 3 or 4 New York trials so far this year or something. You know, you'd think he would start paying attention to the New York legal system, you know, and I realize this is the first criminal trial, but there have been a lot of people accusing him of things and their attorneys get to speak. And in New York, the prosecution speaks last.
Yeah. What's interesting to me, though, is, you know, the one thing that I said about the trial seems to be the mainstream narrative right now. And I said from the beginning, I go, I don't know what the outcome's going to be. I don't know all of the ins and outs, but I do know the lawyers aren't going to get paid. And it's amazing how much of the talking head class is going, I doubt these lawyers are getting paid.
Well, is this not the lawyer that got the $3 million in cash up front?
They got a little bit of something, but not what they're going to need to fight this all the way through.
I mean, well, you know, this, if he's found guilty, it's going to appeal in a nanosecond. Probably one of the things they'll try and appeal on is they let the prosecution talk last. This is, I think, the lawyer who was smart enough to say, no, you pay me right now and then I'll start.
I got to tell you,
unfortunately,
though.
Unfortunately, he still has Donald Trump. What I don't get about Donald Trump's lawyers is, especially when he was cross-examining Michael Cohen, was, hi, I'm the new Michael Cohen. You know, I mean, you're looking at what Donald Trump does to attorneys. And you're the attorney trying to do it to the last guy. And you don't think it's going to happen to you. It's like the woman who thinks that this guy, who's a horrible human being to every other girlfriend he's ever had, is going to make an exception for her.
You're special.
Right? That's what Donald Trump's lawyers are like.
No, I'm right there with you. I'm surprised any lawyer would go near him, even a public defender. But you were at the Libertarian Convention. Trump showed up. And as the reports have, was he booed as badly as the reports say?
Well, in my case, I've been at libertarian conventions. Sadly, I was not at this one. So I don't know, although I have confessions, I have watched the booing on loop for about an hour or so because it was just so enjoyable. I mean, the thing that I was the Green Party's vice presidential candidate. It's my little dirty secret that I thought for a while that I could dip my toe into politics, and I've chosen other ways now to try and make a difference in the world. But the one thing I know about third party politics, and I have an enormous amount of respect for the libertarians. The one thing I know about, one of the reasons I have so much respect, is because if they wanted to sell out, they didn't have to wait for Donald Trump, right? The Libertarian Party was invented under Richard Nixon. And they have been fighting against the Republican liberality, how liberal the Republicans are. And to give the devil its due a little bit, in the Nixon administration, I mean, he was the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, OSHA, you know, all that stuff from Nixon, right? So the libertarians were like, he's not conservative enough for us. And they started the Libertarian Party. And when the last Libertarian convention I spoke at, I think was an off year. I think it was 2005, maybe. But I was introduced by Thomas Jefferson. The man was completely dressed as Thomas Jefferson. He asked me to kindly refer to him as Tom. You know, I mean, these people are idealists. Like the Green Party. That's what I love about the Green Party. The Green Party is a party of idealists. And if you think you could get the Green Party to go, I mean, what was it Trump was saying to him? You must like losing. You'll be losers. You're losers all the time. Now you're going to be losers. Go ahead and lose. Excuse me. These people would lose if they gave up their ideals. That's the way they, this is their core belief that they have to do this. And in his totally transactional way of doing absolutely everything, the reason that Donald Trump went to see the libertarians is because they got 110,000 votes in Pennsylvania in 2016. And Trump, who did win Pennsylvania then, only won by 70, right? 70,000. No, so if he's looking at the swing states, he needs those libertarian votes. The Green that year only got like 8,000. We're talking a formidable force, the libertarians. And so he's thinking, I'm razor thin in a lot of these states I have to, these battleground states, if I have the libertarians on my side. So he thought he'd go bully them. He'd go bully the people who want to take away the Department of Education. he's going to bully the people who, I mean, I remember I was in a debate one time for vice president, and the libertarian was also there. And I listened, his name was Campagna, wonderful guy, just a wonderful, smart, kind, idealist man. We disagreed on things like if we need a Department of Education. But I know one thing, if I had voted for him, I would have had half of my most important issues. I would have been out of the Iraq war, and it would have been pro-choice. You know, I mean, the... Wow. That was cool.
That was.
So the libertarians, I mean, we used to call libertarians early in my political days, we called libertarians Republicans who like to smoke dope. But libertarians, I mean, they believe in personal liberty. And this is a guy who wants to take tax dollars and pay for religious education. That's who Donald Trump has said he would support, tax dollars to pay for religious education, getting into a woman's bedroom and telling her what she can and can't do with her body, talking about changing birth control laws. I mean, there is nothing about Donald Trump that would appeal to the Libertarian Party, but he doesn't care because he just sees their votes. It's like he's a bank robber and he sees the cash. It's all he sees.
But here's the thing. I got to give him credit for going. You go and you make your pitch. This is my problem with Democrats. Democrats don't do that. They don't go to the places where people disagree with them. Trump has done that. Republicans do this. They've done it.
You know, I think that's like saying, I mean, I don't call it going and making your pitch when you hit somebody over the head with a baseball bat and take their purse. I mean, this guy went there and he bullied them. He showed them zero respect. He grabbed them by the, right? He tried to do what he does to everybody he thinks is weaker than him. And
so why did they invite him?
Huh?
Why did they invite him?
Well, I guess there was some big split in the Libertarian Party about wanting to invite him or not wanting to invite him, right? And I mean, I saw interviews with a couple of people that left the Libertarian convention who said, if he would give us what we told him we wanted, I'd vote for him. And the only thing that, I mean, he is, I don't want to insult Lucy with the football, but anyone who believes Donald Trump's going to give you what he promised you.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, I know. I'm going through that with my union.
Oh, yeah.
Because we're in the
process. No, I mean, you can't, but there isn't enough snake oil. There aren't enough lies. And trust me, he's tried. There isn't enough reason. You know, I would just, if anyone wants to trust him, I would drag them to New Jersey, go to Bedminster, move a couple of shrubs, and show him his wife. That's the way he treats people that trust him.
Yeah, well.
Buried under the crabgrass, probably with a lot of nuclear codes.
Could quite possibly be. And so did it accomplish anything other than give Trump's name back in the press, other than get a headline? Did this accomplish anything, do you think?
I got a great deal of satisfaction from it, and I don't get that much from him, so I appreciate that part. I think, I don't know. I mean, Trump's, how much more headline can he get? I mean,
it's all
at a point now where he's all the oxygen's gone from the room. It's all Trump all the time, forever. I'm ashamed of myself for how much time I think about him. You know, a lot of dangerous, bad things are going on in the country. We can't even discuss them because we're always talking about him. So I don't think it matters what he does next. If he didn't get a chance to go to the Libertarian convention and get booed, he'd be kicking a puppy or pitching a fit or,
wow.
You know, he's just a horrible human being. And I just want him to stop. I read Mary Trump's book. I want him to go quietly into the good night so I can feel sorry for him, because he's pathetic. But as long as he's a danger to other people, I can't even let my pathos go for this guy. He's a pathetic person who was an unloved child and grew up defective. And I'm not a psychiatrist, but that's what happened to him. I just want to feel bad for him.
All right. Well, you're a better human being than most. I'll give you credit for that. Finally, I got to get your thoughts on this latest internet story that caught my attention. Evidently, this Canadian writer decided that he wanted to disguise himself as a black man and travel throughout the U.S. and find racism. You know, he tweeted out that last summer I disguised myself as a black man and traveled throughout the U.S. to document how racism persists in American society. He says, writing Seven Shoulders was one of the hardest things I've ever done as a journalist. And his name is Sam Forrester. Thoughts on a white guy going in blackface?
I'm a journalist, and I got to agree, fiction is harder to write. So this guy's busy writing a pile of fiction. I'm unwilling to concede that he masqueraded as a black man, because he probably only did it around a bunch of other stupid white people like him. So it was probably hard to tell whether or not he passed it all. You know, I mean, what's his litmus test for whether or not he actually masqueraded as a person of color? And I think, you know, talk about wanting attention, but being unable to be the Donald Trump of the world and get attention for kicking anybody's puppy. This guy is out there. He's what did you say? It was for the Spectator?
He writes for the Spectator and for the National
Review. So he writes for a conservative kind of rag anyway, right? Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, he'll probably sell a bunch of stuff to other people who want to think they're not racist. You know, it'll be one of those little kumbaya moments for people who want to pretend they're not racists, and they can all say,
I'm curious,
we have a friend who dressed up.
I am curious, you know, on you know, because there are no pictures of what he looked like. So to your point, we don't know if he was, you know, what he looked like, or, you know, on the spectrum where he, you know, how far he went or where he went. You know, look, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. High poverty, high dense minority community. I don't know that guy comes in my neighborhood and gets out. So, that's one of these. Who did you just go to the Starbucks and you know, prance around? Or did you actually go into real neighborhoods real people are to experience what real systematic racism is, other than just trying to write some kind of halfway book.
I'm willing to bet he didn't even do, you know, as you're saying, generic white people retail. I'm betting he probably just hung around with his same old buddies and thought, they don't recognize me. You know, I mean, I haven't read the story. I got no idea, but the premise of it is racist. Before he left his house, I think it was a racist premise, you know? Yeah. So.
I don't know. It's not a good idea. Not a good idea, but we'll see where the blowback goes. But as always, Pat, I appreciate the input, the thoughts, the time. Hope folks will check out your work over at the Bucks County Beacon, where you do amazing stuff. As always, thanks so much. Our good friend Pat LaMarche. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Think it's a good idea to dress up in a costume and pretend to be, well, something you're not, especially, you know, a black guy walking around? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Back after this.
This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
Enjoying this local program?
Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Frost advisory in effect overnight, as we'll see temperatures as you wake up Thursday morning in the mid and upper 30s, light winds and clear skies. After the chilly start, look for sunshine, south winds developing, they'll be gusty, highs in the lower 70s. It's 53 at our studios.
Nightline with Pete Schwabba.
Melissa was my neighbor in L.A. Her husband, Jim, would break open these $100 bottles of wine they just have sitting around.
A friend of mine and I went to his friend's house. Her dad put like a $500 bottle of scotch down on the table and was like, hey, I got this for you guys. Like, go ahead. We're 18. We can't appreciate this. I've never had an alcoholic beverage in my life until my 21st birthday.
Nightline with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights 7 till 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So remember when conservatives used to at least pretend that their policies weren't simply designed to make the rich richer and the poor poorer? Remember? When at least there was the illusion that there was something that might trickle down on you and me? Well, a new study from Princeton shows that, well, remember those voucher schemes coming out of Iowa? The educational savings accounts, they were supposed to be the savior of education for poor kids in the state. Well, surprise, surprise, we find out that all the vouchers have actually done, or what they seem to be doing, is diverting money away from public education and driving up the tuition of these private schools who are supposed to be the saviors. And you know, why? Well, they keep the poor kids out, of course. And a nice windfall for the wealthier families, as it was designed. Surprised? Shouldn't be. This is conservative economics at its finest. These are the policies that they've brought us. Here to share some thoughts on the top stories in the world of economics around the country, I've asked our good friend Mateus Vernango to come talk with us. He's a professor of economics there at Bucknell University. Mateus, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
So I look at this story, and again, you know, all of these schemes that they keep coming up with, my Republican friends keep coming up with, to destroy the commons, to destroy what we the people hold collectively and put into private hands, never seems to work out the way they sell it. It was never about helping poor kids, in my view. It's about getting more taxpayer cash into the hands of wealthier people.
I think that it does work the way they you know, sort of thought it should. They just are being deceptive. So they're terrible policies with the terrible consequence at the end of the day are what they want. On vouchers, I should say. So it's a story that I don't know how many of your listeners, know, but the original proposal is from Milton Friedman, the Uber Pope of conservative economics. And he came up with that proposal in 1955, and the point of this is he came with that up the following year after Brown versus Board of Education.
Right.
And the following year was adopted, you know, once, you know, they tried to integrate schools in Virginia by white supremacists. And in his famous book, Capitalism and Freedom, in 1962, Friedman has a whole chapter on vouchers. And he does say that these are being used effectively. That was the point, by some people in Virginia. And so the whole notion was, so if you're going to integrate schools and you're going to have black kids with white kids, this allows the white parents to keep their kids in segregated schools. And so that was one of the objectives. There's a whole debate of whether Friedman knew, didn't, you know, and all of those things. But at the end of the day, it is, you know, a way of maintaining, you know, and, you know, in this particular case, I think separating and segregating different groups of the working class so that they can sort of divide and conquer.
No, we agree 100%, but we were sold on the idea that these vouchers were to help poor kids get out of failing schools and give them opportunities they were never going to get. We got to destroy those government schools and let the free market work its will. And, well, all they're doing is cashing in.
That education wasn't something that the state, the government should have. You know, by the way, Adam Smith was for the idea that education should be something that the government should be involved with. So the notion that this is somehow connected to liberal ideas going back in time is preposterous. But yes, it's the notion that the government, in Ronald Reagan's phrase, is you know, is the problem, not part of the solution. So that's still in place. So it's a terrible idea. It's, as you said, I didn't read about this particular study, but it's not surprising that that doesn't work out.
It never seems to work out the way they sell it to us. You know, for privatization schemes that they get, they sell us all the way on down. But the reason that I asked you on is because I'm sure you've been seeing the polls that are out that people, a large number of people in the country, believe that we're actually right now in a recession and have been for some time. There's all of this polling data out there, and I don't generally put a lot of stock in it, but it's driving a lot of news stories. That I think, you know, reinforces the narrative that the economy is not doing very well. But, you know, what do you make of that polling data that says, look, you know, so many people think that the economy is not well, we're on the wrong track, we're in the middle of a recession, all of this bad kind of negativity. What do you make of that as an economist?
So I think that it reflects the fact that, you know, the economy has been tough, not in the last year and a half, in the last four decades. It has been tough for working class people, for the middle class. So it has not been thriving. Wages, as you know, have stagnated in comparison to the growth of productivity, not right now, in the last 40 years. So the previous, you know, the period that goes from, you know, the post-war period until the 70s, you know, it's a period of huge increase of wages above productivity, in which a middle class is formed, in which, you know, if you had a high school and a blue collar job, you were middle class and had some certainty about, you know, your economic future and the future of your kids. And today, even with a college degree, you don't have that kind of security. I think it does reflect the uncertainties, and I don't want to minimize the issues of what people do have. Also, I should say, even though the wages of those at the bottom have, over the last, you know, since inflation started to fall, have grown above inflation, overall, they still have, you know, lost a bit. And also there is the fact that a lot of the remaining inflation, which is much lower than it was, but, you know, it's still, you know, above. I mean, the target from the Fed is not particularly important, but, you know, it's in the issues that affect working class people. So rent, you know, the mortgages, because the interest rates are high, on those things, which take a huge chunk of your income. So if you have to pay more on rent, you know, you're not doing other things. You're not going to go this summer to get a vacation and whatnot. And you know, and that hurts people. And so I think that there is an element of this that it's not, you know, not crazy to think that they have a certain sense of, you know, the economy not being great.
And you're right. I mean, prices are high and wages haven't kept up. But that, as you pointed out, is not new. And I go back to, you know, when I started working back in the mid to late 80s, My wages, you know, compared to my standard of living compared to today, were much higher back in the late 80s. You know, I started a job, the same job, kind of job I'm doing now, started off at $15 an hour, top rate, $18 an hour. And if you use that little cute inflation calculator that the Bureau of Labor Statistics has, I should be making in the $49 an hour range. Had my wages kept up with inflation, it'd be almost $50 an hour. I'm at 30. There's a $20 gap in standard of living that went somewhere else. And I'm just one guy who's had a union to at least try and help keep up with
profits. We lost. This is that's it. So you have it. And that's what I'm saying. It's a general story. So it's very difficult for Democrats when they come to power and to sell this stuff, because that is there. So what I was going to say, having said that, the recovery has, if you're in Europe, England, in which probably the Tories are going to be trounced by and Labour probably will return. They're not growing. They're close to zero growth. The recovery was not particularly good. In Germany, has been a terrible recovery. So the Biden recovery has been, incredibly good. So it has been incredibly good.
Why do we hear that? So, I mean, I've said that myself. I've heard other people say it. But the narrative, the mainstream narrative is all bad. Sky's falling. Eggs are $4,000 a dozen.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, that there is the issue of inflation, that it's a complicated one because it we were not used to. So we haven't had any significant inflation for, since the 70s. And so a lot of people are not used to that. And when we had those before, it was still the era in which wages were, bargaining power of the working class was very different back then. And so wages managed to keep up with, and that's why inflation was actually much higher in the 70s than at any point now. I'm one of those that kept saying, look, inflation will not accelerate too much. It's a shock to the supply side. So we have the snags during the pandemic, but it's not going to keep up because workers don't have a lot of power and cannot keep pushing it and whatnot. And so, this is going to sort of flame out, which it did. So it's not the Fed that stopped inflation. If anything, the Fed should have interest rates slightly lower, issues associated, as I said, to the housing market and rents and whatnot. But they're paranoid about inflation. So I think that paranoia about inflation is driven by financial markets. It's somewhat inevitable that working class people are not happy with that. The middle class is not. I'm not happy with that. So Bucknell doesn't increase wages with all of the inflation. And so I think that is one of the things that I'm sorry to say, incumbents do pay a price for that. It is a tough position to be in.
But, let me ask you
important this. Things that have been done for the long run. And I'm afraid of what happens with those policies if we sort of change track.
No, this is where I wanted to go, because, one of the things that I give Biden credit for, the investments that they're making in the future. We're investing in infrastructure. We're reshoring some manufacturing. We're strategically looking at industries to reshore, to protect for the future, such as chips. We've got something of an industrial policy. I'd like it to be much bigger, much bolder, but we've got something of an industrial policy. But I listen to people like Scott Perry, my congressman, who says, all this spending is what's causing the inflation. It's all Biden's fault. We got to stop all this spending. What happens to the economy if, let's say, Trump takes office on January 20th of 2025, and they do what they say they're going to do, and all of the infrastructure investments and all of the investments in these new industries and all of this stuff, and just stop? What happens?
So first of all, let me say this. The idea that inflation was caused by spending is utterly incorrect. Inflation, sort of went up and down, starting in March 2021 and then very fast down starting in 2023. And so the peak was 8%, so which is, I come from Latin America. We did in Argentina with 200 and something percent. Yeah. So, it's a triple. I mean, again, it is hurting people. So everything that we said, but it is clearly those snags in the supply chain and the price of oil because of the war. So that was it. Wages did not follow for a long while. and the implication of that, that who benefit from that inflation is corporations. So that's the story. I think it's well established that that's the story. So I don't think that there is any doubt. The Fed, hiked interest rates, as if it was demand. And I should say the GDP has been sort of slowing. So we're still in a recovery, but, we're very close to, again, it's not necessarily a situation that, helps a lot of people. And there are a lot of people that are discouraged and not, fully employed as they would want. But, we're close to full employment. I mean, unemployment has been below 4% for the longest period ever. So I want to make that part clear. So the investments are not only good because the United States always does some sort of industrial policy through the Pentagon. The important thing here is that it's an industrial policy that it's concerned with manufacturing at home. And that would bring good jobs back to the United States. And that's the importance of the Biden industrial policy, as opposed to, say, what Trump was doing, because Trump was being harsh on China, whatever you want to talk about and whatnot. The explicit difference is that Biden is trying to do things that, one, in the long term, investing in, say, for example, electric cars, pushing some of those investments to do things that would prevent some of the catastrophes that happen because of global warming, which we will have much more of those. So that is essential because, the people that are going to lose their houses, the people that are going to, sort of be in areas that they, cannot reconstruct, that, they're going to be, their houses will be burned, flooded, it is all working class people. So the elites are going to be safe. And so that's an important investment in the future. And, as I said, and it's manufacturing jobs, and those strengthen the position of the working class. So if they cut the public investment on those things, those investments don't happen. It's as simple as that. So these are things that either the government does or they're not done. I always say, and people don't tend to understand that, because as we talked several times in this program, there is an ethos in American society that goes back in time. The idea of the American dream is tied up with this idea of the self-made man. That I made this, that it's only you. And when Obama famously said, you didn't make this, he wasn't incorrect. You cannot think of many of the great corporations in America without, the fact that you have, going back in time to Hamilton and the, first government of the Republic, that you have, the government as a contractor. Government purchases make, in many cases, the fortunes of the great sort of entrepreneurs. So Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, all of those guys get contracts. They don't build those rockets that go to the to the near space because that's profitable. They do that because they do get money from the Pentagon and the Defense Department and NASA and so on and so forth. So that's how this sort of works. So the effects of that, combined with most likely some of these tax cuts for the wealthy that are going to be permanent, because Biden would make some of the tax cuts for the lower class sort of remain. Then we should actually increase the taxes on the very wealthy, but those will not come back. So people are afraid that they shouldn't with the size of American debt. I would say the problem is not the size of the debt or even of the deficits. The problem is how we use the money. So we're going to use the money very poorly to do things that will not help us deal with the big issues of the future, inequality, climate change, to promote growth in a way that it's sustainable. So those are the dangers of a new and renewed Trump presidency on the economic front. Of course, on the political front, I'm considerably more afraid.
No, I'm right there with you. But for me, we talked about the 70s for a moment, and I remember family members who they were paying 10-12% interest on mortgages. My grandparents, for instance, they bought their house in the 60s. And, by the end of the 70s, their mortgage was a day's pay because their union contracts had cost of living adjustments. And in several years, they got multiple raises in the year. So, you know, for me, the thing that Biden's doing that I think is most important is having people at the Department of Labor, at the NLRB, who are pushing for collective bargaining rights, who are enforcing the rules as they were meant to be enforced, so that we have that bargaining power. Because, you know, look, if we had the ability to keep wages up with inflation, I don't think you have this kind of freak out.
Exactly. Inflation only matters because wages have fallen behind inflation, and that's the story. So if if wages are above inflation, you're fine, and people wouldn't be complaining. Exactly what you said. If your wages allow you that, you know, at the end of the day, even with high interest rates, you're paying a triple for your mortgage, people wouldn't care. If you still have, you know, and can provide a decent life to your family, you know, people don't care. But when you can't, you know, people are frustrated. Yep. And then you can exploit all the other sort of social issues that Republicans will exploit in this election cycle. So issues of race, ethnicity, immigration, and so on and so forth.
Last question I've got for you, because, you know, this narrative, I'm getting a lot of contact from people saying that the economy's terrible, you know, Biden's done all these horrible things. Is there a messaging vehicle? You know, I was quoted in the Hill piece, you know, saying, look, the reality is I think they've got really good things to run on. They just don't have a vehicle to explain what they did. It's like buying your kid the greatest Christmas present ever. And, you know, it's sitting in the Amazon warehouse because there's no UPS driver to deliver it. They don't seem to have the vehicles to deliver the message of what they're doing or what the vision is and sell people on what the future looks like. But I'm curious, do you have any thoughts on, does this break by election time, or is this going to be a real problem for Biden?
I think it's going to be a real problem. It's very hard to you know, sell around, you know, the sort of general sort of feeling that the economy has not been great. Again, it's not his fault. This is, you know, as economies of the world come. But that doesn't, you know, if I tell somebody, oh, people are much worse in Europe, people are much worse in Argentina, people are much worse in Mexico, they don't give a damn. You know, I mean, they don't care about that. If you tell them that, you know, well, but we recovered and some of these policies in place in the long run are essential. As you said, you know, we have in the news, you know, we have new unions in the South, in places where they never had unions before. And so there is a renewal of the union movement. But, you know, those things are, you know, will show up in the distant future. So how do you sell, you know, the recovery was good, but I know you're still suffering, and in the future those things will pay off. So it is very hard. It is, you know, difficult to sell this kind of stuff. My hope in that respect is that the Republicans and Trump are very incompetent too in terms of their ability to sell their own, and they made a blunder, I think, with the issues of abortion and whatnot. So there might be, you know, some issues that might help Biden, but the economy will be a tough one. I'm sorry to say.
Yeah, I'm with you, Mateus. I appreciate the thoughts, the input. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Our good friend, Mateus Fernando. I want to hear your thoughts. What do you think? Is it going to be a problem for Biden? Are you seeing the economy improving? Are you one of the folks who thinks we're in the middle of a recession? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1941. That was the day that the animators at Walt Disney went out on strike. Attempts to organize a union for cartoonists had begun a decade earlier, resulting in the formation of the Screen Cartoonists Guild in 1938. Then, in 1941, Warner Brothers locked out its Looney Tunes cartoonists for joining the guild. But after 6 days, the company gave in to the union. That set the stage for a showdown at Disney. In its early days, the Disney Company had a reputation as a good employer. Walt Disney provided profit sharing for its cartoonists. But with the success of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, Disney started putting more of the profits into a new studio. The workplace became more corporate and hierarchical. Employees became increasingly frustrated with the wide differences in pay various animators earned. Art Babbitt, the highest paid animator on the staff, decided to sign up with the Cartoonists Guild. He was quickly fired. Outraged, 200 cartoonists walked off the job. The strike waged on for 5 weeks. A federal mediator was brought in and sided with the union on almost every issue. The strike even managed to make its way into one of Disney's movies. At the time of the work action, the company was creating the circus-based cartoon film Dumbo. Some of the non-union cartoonists put in a scene where a group of clowns go to ask the boss for a big raise. The scene was meant to poke fun at the union.
Look out! Look out! Pink elephants on parade, here they come, hippity-hoppity, they're here, and there are pink elephants everywhere.
For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
In braid, pink elephants on parade.
What'll I do? What'll I do? What an unusual view.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the reality, as we were talking about with Mateus, if we had union density like we had back in the 70s, I go back to, I don't think the inflation problem would be as much and as significant as it's been. And look, I understand people are struggling. You know, in our household, we've got to make decisions. And part of how you bring inflation back down is you make those decisions. Say, you know what? Too damn high. We're not buying it. And eventually prices have to come somewhat down and get a little bit more competitive. But until we take on corporate greed, until we take on the mass consolidation of industry after industry, look, they know they got us. They know we're going to keep buying it. We're not going to stop. We're hooked. They got us. We're addicted. So for me, the idea is you go back and you increase union density. You go back to the 70s. What was it, like 27%, 28%? It's now 6.6 in the private sector. So the bargaining power of workers for their wages to keep up hasn't been there for decades. This is not a new problem. This is something we've been talking about on this program for almost all 19 years I've been doing this. Because the standard of living of the average working class person in this country has been stagnant and declining for years. And it's not just wages. It's healthcare benefits, it's pension security, it's all of those things that, you know, when I entered the workforce, things were declining, but there was still the remnants of overtime after 8 hours, working a 40-hour work week and your job being over. Getting health care from your employer that you didn't have to have skin in the game. You weren't reaching into your pocket every week to pay not just the co-pays, the deductibles, the co-insurance, the all out-of-network costs. You didn't pay for the insurance. It was part of your compensation package. You had a defined benefit pension, not a defined contribution plan. So at the end of 40 years, you got a gold watch, you got a pension. They took all that away. They clawed all of that back because they sold us on a whole bunch of bad ideas. And again, I go back to, this is what conservative economics has gotten us. And I'm not saying Republican or Democrat. I'm saying conservative. This is where the Milton Friedman types and the wealth class, the neoliberals who were, you know, part of that as well. We can have all this free trade and get cheap stuff. Yeah, don't worry about those jobs you're losing. So for me, when I look at this moment, there's an opportunity here. The opportunity is for working people to go, yeah, maybe we should be getting paid higher wages. Inflation's going up. Our wages should keep up. Because understand, if your wages keep up with inflation, your standard of living doesn't go down. If you don't have the bargaining power to say, hey, prices are going up, my wages should too, so that I can continue to consume at the same level, then you're falling behind. And how many working people, again, in this country have that kind of bargaining power? Well, 6.6% in the private sector, about a little over 10% of the entire economy. That means 90% of the workforce is, well, desperate. You know, they're at the beck and call. They're the at-will folk. So what do we do? For me, it's about organizing. For me, it's about, hey, maybe what we do is we start joining and forming unions again. Not just to pull us back together as a society and do all the good things that I think come of that, but just the pure economics of corporate America is making good profits. Profits that your labor created. Maybe you should get some of it. Just a thought. Want to hear yours, though? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@therickssmithshow.com.
This is the Buzz of the North. WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.